Jessie sat back in her chair and lit another cigarette, absently aware that the tip of her tongue was stinging from tobacco overload, that her head ached, and that her kidneys were protesting this marathon session in front of the Mac, protesting vigorously. The house was deathly silent, the sort of silence that could only mean that tough little Megan Landis had taken herself off to the supermarket and the dry cleaners. Jessie was amazed that Maggie had left without making at least one more effort to separate her from the computer screen. Then she guessed the housekeeper had known it would be a wasted effort. Best to let her get it out of her system, whatever it is, Maggie would have thought. And it was only a job to her, after all. This last thought sent a little pang through Jessie's heart. A board creaked upstairs. Jessie's cigarette stopped an inch shy of her lips.
"He's back!" Goody shrieked. "Oh, Jessie, he's back!"
Except he wasn't. Her eyes drifted to the narrow face looking up at her from the clusters of newsprint dots, and she thought, "I know exactly where you are, you whore dog. Don't I?" She did, but part of her mind went on insisting it was him just the same. No, not him, it. The space cowboy, the specter of love, back again for a return engagement. It had only been waiting for the house to be empty, and if she picked up the phone on the corner of the desk, she would find it stone dead, just as all the phones in the house by the lake had been stone dead that night. "Your friend Brandon can smile all he wants, but we know the truth, don't we, Jessie?" She suddenly shot out her good hand, snatched the telephone handset from the cradle, and brought it to her ear. Heard the reassuring buzz of the dial tone. Put it back again. An odd, sunless smile played about the corners of her mouth. "Yes, I know exactly where you are, motherfucker. Whatever Goody and the rest of the voices may think, Punkin and I know you're wearing an orange jumpsuit and sitting in a county jail cell. The one at the far end of the old wing," Brandon said, "so the other inmates can't get to you and fuck you up before the state hauls you in front of a jury of your peers. If a thing like you has any peers, we may not be entirely free of you yet, but we will be. I promise you, we will be." Her eyes drifted back to the VDT. And although the vague sleepiness brought on by the combination of the pill and the sandwich had long since dissipated, she felt a bone-deep weariness and a complete lack of belief in her ability to finish what she had started. "This is the time to talk about Raymond Andrew Joubert," she had written. But was it? Could she? She was so tired. Of course she was. She had been pushing that goddamn cursor across the VDT screen almost all day. Pushing the envelope, they called it. And if you pushed the envelope long enough and hard enough, you tore it wide open. Maybe it would be best to just go upstairs and take a nap. Better late than never and all that shit. She could file this to memory, retrieve it tomorrow morning, go back to work on it then. Punkin's voice stopped her. This voice came only infrequently now, and Jessie listened very carefully to it when it did. "If you decide to stop now, Jessie, don't bother to file the document. Just delete it. We both know you'll never have the guts to face Joubert again. Not the way a person has to face a thing she's writing about. Sometimes it takes heart to write about a thing, doesn't it? To let that thing out of the room way in the back of your mind and pull it up there on the screen." "Yes," she murmured. "A yard of heart. Maybe more." She dragged at her cigarette, then snuffed it out, half smoked. She riffled through the clippings a final time and looked out at the window at the slope of Eastern Prom. The snow had long since stopped, and the sun was shining brightly, although it wouldn't be for much longer. February days in Maine are thankless, miserly things. "What do you say, Punkin?" Jessie asked the empty room. She spoke in the haughty Elizabeth Taylor voice she had favored as a child, the one that had driven her mother completely bonkers.
Shall we carry on, my dear?
There was no answer, but Jessie didn't need one. She leaned forward in her chair and set the cursor in motion once more. She didn't stop again for a long time, not even to light a cigarette. This is the time to talk about Raymond Andrew Joubert. It won't be easy, but I'm going to do my best. So pour yourself another cup of coffee, dear. And if you've got a bottle of brandy handy, you may want to doctor it up a bit. Here comes part three. I have all the newspaper clippings beside me on the desk. And if I get up nerve enough to actually send this letter, I'm starting to think I might. I'll include Xeroxes of them. But the articles and the news items don't tell all I know, let alone all there is to know. I doubt if anyone has the slightest idea of all the things Joubert did, including Joubert himself, I imagine, and that's probably a blessing. The stuff the papers could only hint at, and the stuff that didn't make them at all, is real nightmare fodder, and I wouldn't want to know all of it. Most of the stuff that isn't in the papers came to me during the last week, courtesy of a strangely quiet, strangely chastened Brandon Milleran. I'd asked him to come over as soon as the connections between Joubert's story and my own had become too obvious to ignore. "You think this was the guy, don't you?" he asked. "The one who was in the house with you?" "Brandon," I said, "I know it's the guy." He sighed, looked down at his hands for a minute, then looked up at me again. We were in this very room. It was 9 o'clock in the morning, and there were no shadows to hide his face that time. "I owe you an apology," he said. "I didn't believe you then." "I know," I said as kindly as I could. "But I do now, dear God. How much do you want to know, Jess?" I took a deep breath and said, "Everything you can find out." He wanted to know why. "I mean, if you say it's your business and I should butt out, I guess I'll have to accept that. But you're asking me to reopen a matter the firm considers closed. If someone who knows I was watching out for you last fall notices me sniffing around Joubert this winter, it's not impossible that..." "That you could get in trouble," I said. It was something I hadn't considered. "Yes," he said. "But I'm not terribly concerned about that. I'm a big boy, and I can take care of myself. At least I think I can. I'm a lot more concerned about you, Jess. You could wind up on the front page again, after all our work to get you off it as quickly and as painlessly as possible. Even that's not the major thing. It's miles from the major thing. This is the nastiest criminal case to break in northern New England since World War II. I mean, some of this stuff is so gruesome it's radioactive, and you shouldn't plink yourself down in the fallout zone without a damned good reason." He laughed, a little nervously. "Hell, I shouldn't plink myself down there without a damned good reason." I got up, walked across to him, and took one of his hands with my left hand. "I couldn't explain in a million years why," I said. "But I think I can tell you what. Will that do, at least for a start?" He folded his hand gently over mine and nodded his head. "There are three things," I said. "First, I need to know he's real. Second, I need to know the things he did are real. Third, I need to know I'll never wake up again with him standing in my bedroom." That brought it all back, Ruth. And I began to cry. There was nothing tricky or calculating about those tears. They just came. Nothing I could have done would have stopped them. "Please help me, Brandon," I said. "Every time I turn off the light, he's standing across from me in the dark. And I'm so afraid that unless I can turn a spotlight on him, that's going to go on forever. There isn't anybody else I can ask. And I have to know. Please help me." He let go of my hand, produced a handkerchief from somewhere inside that day's screamingly neat lawyer suit, and wiped my face with it. He did it as gently as my mom used to when I came into the kitchen bawling my head off because I'd skinned my knee. That was back in the early years, before I'd turned into the family's squeaky wheel, you understand. All right, he said at last. I'll find out everything I can, and I'll pass it all on to you. Unless and until you tell me to stop, that is. But I have a feeling you better fasten your seatbelt. He found out quite a lot, and now I'm going to pass it on to you, Ruth. But fair warning, he was right about the seatbelt. If you decide to skip some of the next few pages, I'll understand. I wish I could skip writing them, but I have an idea that's also part of the therapy. The final part, I hope. This section of the story, what I suppose I could call Brandon's tale, starts back in 1984 or 1985. That was when cases of graveyard vandalism started popping up in the Lakes District of Western Maine. There were similar cases reported in half a dozen small towns across the state line and into New Hampshire. Stuff like tombstone tipping, spray paint graffiti, and stealing commemorative flags is pretty common stuff out in the Willywags. And of course, there's always a bunch of smashed pumpkins to swamp out of the local boneyard on November 1st. But these crimes went a lot further than pranks or petty theft. Desecration was the word Brandon used when he brought me his first report late last week. And that word had started showing up on most of the police crime report forms by 1988. The crimes themselves seemed abnormal to the people who discovered them and to those who investigated them. But the modus operandi was sane enough, carefully organized and focused. Someone, possibly two or three someones, but more likely a single person, was breaking into the crypts and mausoleums of small-town cemeteries with the efficiency of a good burglar breaking into a house or store. He was apparently arriving at these jobs equipped with drills, a bolt cutter, heavy-duty hacksaws, and probably a winch. Brandon says a lot of four-wheel drive vehicles come equipped with them these days. The breaks were always aimed at the crypts and mausoleums, never at individual graves, and almost all of them came in winter, when the ground is too hard to dig in, and the bodies have to be stored until the deep frost lets go. Once the perpetrator gained entry, he used the bolt cutter and power drill to open the coffins. He systematically stripped the corpses of any jewelry they might have been wearing when they were interred. He used pliers to pull gold teeth and teeth with gold fillings. Those acts are despicable, but at least they're understandable. Robbery was only where this guy got started, though. He gouged out eyes, tore off ears, cut dead throats. In February of 1989, two corpses in the Chilton Remembrance Cemetery were found without noses. He apparently knocked them off with a hammer and a chisel. The officer who caught that one told Brandon, "It would have been easy. It was like a deep freeze in there, and they probably broke off like popsicles." The real question is, what does a guy do with two frozen noses once he has them? Does he put them on his keychain? Maybe sprinkle them with nacho cheese and then zap them in the microwave? What? Almost all the desecrated corpses were found minus feet and hands, sometimes also arms and legs, and in several cases the man doing this also took heads and sex organs. Forensic evidence suggests he used an axe and a butcher knife for the gross work, and a variety of scalpels for the finer stuff. He wasn't bad, either. A talented amateur, one of the Chamberlain County deputies told Brandon. I wouldn't want him working on my gallbladder, but I guess I'd trust him to take a mole off my arm, if he was full of Halcyon or Prozac, that is. In a few cases, he opened up the bodies and or skull cases and filled them with animal excrement. What the police saw more frequently were cases of sexual desecration. He was an equal opportunity kind of guy when it came to stealing gold teeth, jewelry, and limbs, but when it came to taking sexual equipment and having sex with the dead, he stuck strictly to the gentleman. This may have been extremely lucky for me. I learned a lot about the way rural police departments work during the month or so following my escape from our house by the lake, but that's nothing compared to what I've learned in the last week or so. One of the most surprising things is how discreet and tactful small-town cops can be. I guess when you know everybody in the area you patrol by their first names, and are related to a good many of them, discretion becomes almost as natural as breathing. The way they handled my case is one example of this strange, sophisticated discretion. The way they handled Joubert's is another. The investigation went on for 7 years, remember, and a lot of people were in on it before it ended. 2 state police departments, 4 county sheriffs, 31 deputies, and God knows how many local cops and constables. It was right there at the front of their open files, and by 1989 they even had a name for him, Rudolph, as in Valentino. They talked about Rudolph when they were in district court, waiting to testify on their other cases. They compared notes on Rudolph at law enforcement seminars in Augusta and Derry and Waterville. They batted him around on their coffee breaks. And we took him home, one of the cops told Brandon. The same guy who told him about the noses, as a matter of fact. You bet we did. Guys like us always take guys like Rudolph home. You catch up on the latest details at backyard barbecues. Maybe batted around with a buddy from another department while you're watching your kids play Little League ball. Because you never know when you're going to put something together in a new way and hit the jackpot. But here's the really amazing part. And you're probably way ahead of me, if you're not in the bathroom tossing your cookies, that is. For all those years, all those cops knew they had a real live monster. A ghoul, in fact, running around the western part of the state. And the story never surfaced in the press until Joubert was caught. In a way, I find that weird and a little spooky. But in a much larger way, I find it wonderful. I guess the law enforcement battle isn't going so well in a lot of the big cities. But out here in East Overshoe, whatever they're doing still seems to work just fine. Of course, you could argue that there's plenty of room for improvement when it takes 7 years to catch a nut like Joubert. But Brandon clarified that for me in a hurry. He explained that the perp, they really do use that word, was operating exclusively in one-horse towns where budget shortfalls have forced the cops to deal only with the most serious and immediate problems, which means crimes against the living rather than the dead. The cops say there are at least 2 hot car rings and 4 chop shops operating in the western half of the state, and those are only the ones they know about. Then there's the murderers, the wife-beaters, the robbers, the speeders, and the drunks. Above all, there's the old dopola. It gets bought, it gets sold, it gets grown, and people keep hurting or killing each other over it. According to Brandon, the police chief over in Norway won't even use the word cocaine anymore. He calls it powdered shithead, and in his written reports he calls it powdered S-blank-D. I got the point he was trying to make. When you're a small-town cop trying to ride herd on the whole freak show, in a 4-year-old Plymouth cruiser that feels like it's going to fall apart every time you push it over 70, your job gets prioritized in a hurry, and a guy who likes to play with dead people is a long way from the top of the list. I listened to all this carefully, and I agreed. But not all the way. Some of it feels true, but some of it feels a little self-serving, I said. I mean, the stuff Joubert was doing. Well, it went a little further than just playing with dead people, didn't it? Or am I wrong? You're not wrong at all, he said. What neither of us wanted to come right out and say was that for 7 years this aberrant soul had gone flitting from town to town, getting blowjobs from the dead. And to me, putting a stop to that seemed quite a bit more important than nabbing teenage girls who'd been shoplifting cosmetics at a local drugstore, or finding out who's been growing goofy weed in the woodlot behind the Baptist church. But the important thing is that no one forgot him, and everyone kept comparing notes. A perp like Rudolph makes cops uneasy for all kinds of reasons, but the major one is that a guy crazy enough to do things like that to dead people might be crazy enough to try doing them to ones that are still alive. Not that you live very long after Rudolph decided to split your head open with his trusty axe. The police were also troubled by the missing limbs. What were those for? Brandon says an uncredited memo saying, maybe Rudolph the lover is really Hannibal the cannibal, circulated briefly in the Oxford County Sheriff's Office. It was destroyed not because the idea was regarded as a sick joke. It wasn't. But because the sheriff was afraid it might leak to the press. Whenever one of the local law enforcement agencies could afford the men and the time, they'd stake out some boneyard or other. There are a lot of them in western Maine, and I guess it had almost become kind of a hobby to some of these guys by the time the case finally broke. The theory was just that if you keep shooting the dice long enough, you're bound to roll your point sooner or later. And that, essentially, is what finally happened. Early last week, actually about 10 days ago now, Castle County Sheriff Norris Ridgwick and one of his deputies were parked in the doorway of an abandoned barn close to Homeland Cemetery. This is on a secondary road that runs by the back gate. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were just getting ready to pack it in for the night when the deputy, John LaPointe, heard a motor. They never saw the van until it was actually pulling up to the gate, because it was a snowy night and the guy's headlights weren't on. Deputy LaPointe wanted to take the guy as soon as they saw him get out of the van and go to work on the wrought iron cemetery gate with a spreader. But the sheriff restrained him. Ridgwick's a funny-looking duck, Brandon said, but he knows the value of a good bust. He never loses sight of the courtroom in the heat of the moment. He learned from Alan Pangborn, the guy who had the job before him, and that means he learned from the best. 10 minutes after the van went in through the gate, Ridgwick and LaPointe followed with their own headlights out, and their unit just barely creeping along through the snow. They followed the van's tracks until they were pretty sure where the guy was going. The town crypt set into the side of the hill. Both of them were thinking Rudolph, but neither one of them said so out loud. LaPointe said it would have been like jinxing a guy who's throwing a no-hitter. Ridgwick told his deputy to stop the cruiser just around the side of the hill from the crypt. Said he wanted to give the guy all the rope he needed to hang himself. As it turned out, Rudolph ended up with enough to hang himself from the moon. When Ridgwick and LaPointe finally moved in with their guns drawn and their flashlights on, they caught Raymond Andrew Joubert half in and half out of an open coffin. He had his axe in one hand, his cock in the other, and LaPointe said he looked ready to do business with either one. I guess Joubert scared the hell out of them both when they first saw him in their lights, and I'm not a bit surprised. Although I flatter myself that I can imagine better than most what it must have been like, coming on a creature like him in a cemetery crypt at 2 in the morning. All other circumstances aside, Joubert suffers from acromegaly, a progressive enlargement of the hands, feet, and face that happens when the pituitary gland goes into warp drive. It's what caused his forehead to bulge the way it does, and his lips to pooch out. He also has abnormally long arms. They dangle all the way down to his knees. There was a big fire in Castle Rock about a year ago. It burned most of the downtown. And these days the sheriff jugs most serious offenders in Chamberlain or Norway. But neither Sheriff Ridgwick nor Deputy LaPointe wanted to make the trip over snowy roads at 3 in the morning, so they took him back to the renovated shed they're using as a cop shop these days. They claimed it was the late hour and the snowy roads, Brandon said. But I have an idea there was a little more to it than that. I don't think Sheriff Ridgwick wanted to turn over the piñata to anyone else until he'd taken at least one good crack at it himself. Anyway, Joubert was no trouble. He sat in the back of the cruiser, apparently happy as a clam at high tide, looking like something that had escaped from an episode of Tales from the Crypt. And both of them swear this is true, singing Happy Together, that old Turtles tune. Ridgwick radioed ahead for a couple of temp deputies to meet them. He made sure Joubert was locked up tight, and the deputies were armed with shotguns and plenty of fresh coffee before he and LaPointe left again. They drove back to Homeland for the van. Ridgwick put on gloves, sat on one of those green plastic hefty bags the cops like to call evidence blankets when they use them on a case, and ran the vehicle back to town. He drove with all the windows open and said the van still stank like a butcher shop after a 6-day power failure. Ridgwick got his first good look into the back of the van when he got it under the arc lights of the town garage. There were several rotting limbs in the storage compartments running along the sides. There was also a wicker box, much smaller than the one I saw, and a craftsman tool case full of burglar's tools. When Ridgwick opened the wicker box, he found 6 penises strung on a length of jute twine. He said he knew it for what it was at once, a necklace. Joubert later admitted he often wore it when he went out on his graveyard expeditions, and stated his belief that if he'd been wearing it on his last trip, he never would have been caught. "It brung me a power of good luck," he said. And considering how long it took to catch him, Ruth, I think you'd have to say he had a point. The worst thing, however, was the sandwich lying on the passenger seat. The thing poking out from between the 2 slices of Wonder Bread was pretty clearly a human tongue. It had been slathered with that bright yellow mustard kids like. Ridgwick managed to get out of the van before he threw up, Brandon said. Good thing. The state police would have torn him a new asshole if he'd puked on the evidence. On the other hand, I'd have wanted him removed from his job for psychological reasons if he hadn't thrown up. They moved Joubert over to Chamberlain shortly after sunrise, while Ridgwick was turned around in the front seat of the cruiser, reading Joubert his rights through the mesh. It was the 2nd or 3rd time he'd done it. Ridgwick is apparently nothing if not methodical. Joubert interrupted to say he might have done something bad to Daddy Mummy. Awful sorry. They had by that time established from documents in Joubert's wallet that he was living in Motton, a farming town just across the river from Chamberlain. And as soon as Joubert was safely locked up in his new quarters, Ridgwick informed officers from both Chamberlain and Motton what Joubert had told them. On the way back to Castle Rock, Lapointe asked Ridgwick what he thought the cops headed for Joubert's house might find. Ridgwick said, "I don't know, but I hope they remember to take their gas masks." A version of what they found and the conclusions they drew came out in the papers over the following days, growing as it did, of course. But the state police and the Maine Attorney General's office had a pretty good picture of what had been going on in the farmhouse on Kingston Road by the time the sun went down on Joubert's first day behind bars. The couple Joubert called his Daddy Mummy, actually his stepmother and her common-law husband, were dead all right. They'd been dead for months, although Joubert continued to speak as if the something bad had happened only days or hours ago. He had scalped them both and eaten most of Daddy. There were body parts strewn all over the house, some rotting and maggoty in spite of the cold weather, others carefully cured and preserved. Most of the cured parts were male sex organs. On a shelf by the cellar stairs, the police found about 50 ball jars containing eyes, lips, fingers, toes, and testicles. Joubert was quite the home canner. The house was also filled, and I do mean filled, with stolen goods, mostly from summer camps and cottages. Joubert calls them my things. Appliances, tools, gardening equipment, and enough lingerie to stock a Victoria's Secret boutique. He apparently liked to wear it. The police are still trying to sort out the body parts that came from Joubert's grave-robbing expeditions from those that came from his other activities. They believe he may have killed as many as 12 people over the last 5 years, all hitchhiking drifters he picked up in his van. The total may go higher, Brandon says, but the forensic work is very slow. Joubert himself is no help, not because he won't talk, but because he talks too much. According to Brandon, he's confessed to over 300 crimes already, including the assassination of George Bush. He seems to believe Bush is actually Dana Carvey, the guy who plays the church lady on Saturday Night Live. He's been in and out of various mental institutions since the age of 15, when he was arrested for engaging in unlawful sexual congress with his cousin. The cousin in question was 2 at the time. He was a victim of sex abuse himself, of course. His father, his stepfather, and his stepmother all apparently had a go at him. What is it they used to say? The family that plays together stays together. He was sent to Gage Point, a sort of combination detox, halfway house, and mental institution for adolescents in Hancock County, on a charge of gross sexual abuse, and released as cured 4 years later at the age of 19. This was in 1973. He spent the second half of 1975 and most of 1976 at AMHI in Augusta. This was as a result of Joubert's fun with animals period. I know I probably shouldn't be joking about these things, Ruth. You'll think I'm horrible. But in truth, I don't know what else to do. I sometimes feel that if I don't joke, I'll start to cry. And that if I start to cry, I won't be able to stop. He was sticking cats in trash barrels and then blowing them to pieces with the big firecrackers they call can crushers. That's what he was doing. And every now and then, presumably when he needed a break in the old routine, he would nail a small dog to a tree. In 79, he was sent away to Juniper Hill for raping and blinding a 6-year-old boy. This time it was supposed to be for good. But when it comes to politics and state-run institutions, especially state-run mental institutions, I think it's fair to say that nothing is forever. He was released from Juniper Hill in 1984, once more adjudged cured. Brandon feels, and so do I, that this second cure had more to do with cuts in the state's mental health budget than with any miracle of modern science or psychiatry. At any rate, Joubert returned to Motton to live with his stepmother and her common-law, and the state forgot about him. Except to issue him a driver's license, that is. He took a road test and got a perfectly legal one. In some ways, I find this the most amazing fact of all. And at some point in late 1984 or early 1985, he started using it to tour the local cemeteries.